Perfect, perfect. Let's turn to Jonah one more time. Maybe next week too. We'll see. But definitely Jonah today. That's the plan. Spent the last few weeks going through this really incredible story that is maybe a little different than sometimes we think. And so we really just take what we've been singing about and we just kind of keep that going this morning. Before we get into Jonah, I do want to talk about what's coming up in the next few weeks, but how this fits into it. If you were to take the, like, your calendar on your phone or your wall or however you keep a calendar these days, and it starts in January and goes to the end. The church also has a calendar, but it doesn't start in January. It starts with Advent, and it's set up really to bring out the stories that come with Jesus's life and the kingdom work that he's doing over the trajectory of Scripture. And so if we think of the storyline, it's a lot more complicated than this in a good way, but let me just simplify church calendar real quick. It starts off, and we are in the Old Testament. There are the prophets that are longing for the Redeemer to come, and that is Advent. And then the Redeemer shows up. Jesus is born. That's Christmas. And then if you keep going in Jesus' story, there's the, like, going public with the gospel to the nations. And it kind of is celebrated with three things. It's the wise men show up. It is Jesus' baptism and the first public miracle of the water turned to wine at the wedding of Cana. Those three things are Epiphany. Okay, so Advent, we're waiting for him. Christmas, he's here. Epiphany, everything starts going public. Then the next thing that we see Jesus do is he goes into the desert. It's not really a desert, it's more wilderness. So if I say desert out of habit, just know I mean wilderness. He goes to the wilderness for 40 days and he fasts. And that's Lent. And that fast is the beginning of this long journey to the cross, which gets into Holy Week and Maundy Thursday with the Last Supper and the disciples in the upper room. There's the betrayal, the arrest, the crucifixion. There's Good Friday where he dies. There's Silent Saturday. Then there's Resurrection Sunday, which is Easter. Okay, so Advent, Christmas, Epiphany, Lent, Easter. And then there is Pentecost after that, when this Spirit comes, fills believers, and sends us out to the nations. And then the next thing is the return of Christ, which when we come all the way back over to Advent. And so they kind of overlap. And so you can think of it in a linear sense. You can also just think of it as like a big circle, or maybe this way, however you want to think of a circle. But it goes in that loop. And what we do as the people of God and have done for a long time is we work our way through that sequence throughout the course of a year. And then there's times when we lay off of it for a bit, and there's times when we're like, hey, it's on. And so we're about to enter into that next part of Jesus' story, which would be Lent. And Lent is, it's been around since like the middle of the 4th century. By that point, it was very widely practiced. And it has been commonly practiced throughout the ages, except for certain denominations just weren't that into it. And a lot of that is your Baptists and your, like, Assembly of God, more charismatic type. Like, those groups don't really practice it as much, but everybody else has done this for hundreds of years, okay? And so here in South Louisiana, it gets associated with Catholicism, but really it's been everybody's for a long time. And maybe you didn't grow up practicing Lent, and that's great. And if you're new around here, then, like, welcome to a church that practices Lent. And we would love to have you be a part of the journey. And as I said, it's modeled after, there's really two big ideas. One is that long journey to the cross. We can look at it as like kind of a three-year thing from Jesus's, like, his baptism and everything going public and his fasting in the desert. It could be like a long kind of thing, or we could look at it as starting way, way back whenever. It doesn't really matter. But at the beginning of his ministry, he went out and he fasted for 40 days in the wilderness. And so what believers have done for a long time is said, hey, Easter is coming. Jesus had a long journey to the cross, and he saw fit to begin that journey in the wilderness fasting. And so believers for hundreds of years have said, let's join our Savior in the wilderness. Let's do what he did, which is to fast. And let's make our journey to the cross in as many ways as we can, like his journey to the cross. And during that time, as we fast, God has this way of teaching us a lot of different things. It starts on Ash Wednesday, which is the 14th of February. And we have a Ash Wednesday service that we do. There are some traditions where they'll put ashes on your forehead in the shape of a cross. We do not do that, and so sometimes I feel like that keeps people from wanting to come to it because that we don't do that. We incorporate ashes, but it's different, and it's on the 14th, so it's 10 days away. And I know that you're thinking, hey, what about Valentine's Day? And I would say, yeah, Valentine's Day. What a great way to celebrate Valentine's Day, by going to an Ash Wednesday service. Really? Like, that's a fantastic date night, dudes. That worship service is really that's day one of us going and sitting in the wilderness. And so we're going to get together, and we're going to do that intentionally together. It will be a simple service, but we're looking at ways to make it a little different than, like, a Sunday. For it to be an interactive time, for it to be very meaningful and very purposed. And so I would encourage you to, Valentine's Day can happen at any point. Ash Wednesday happens Ash Wednesday. And I think you need to be there. I said it last week and I'll keep saying it. I know that it won't work for everyone, and so we won't take attendance or anything like that, but it is a beginning for us. And so for 40 days, there's a couple of things we do. The main thing that we do is we fast. And I know that fasting might seem a little bit difficult, and that's good because it is. Fasting has to do with your stomach. You're like this God right here, you know. We interrupt our eating rhythms, and we do that on purpose. It's a disruption. And so there are a few ways that happens. One is that on corporately as a group, what we've done for the last few years is, like, every Wednesday, let's fast lunch on Wednesdays as a church. And it's not just about, oh, I'm not going to eat lunch. It's I'm going to take that time and that block, and instead of eating food, I'm going to, like, eat something else. I'm going to, like, feast on God's word. I'm going to take that time to pray. And so if you have a lunch break and you can, like, find peace and quiet somewhere, it's not just what you are not doing, it's also what are you doing in its place. And so we as a church, we're not asking everyone to do a 40-day fast. We're not asking anyone to do that kind of stuff. But we are saying, like, hey, what if we all took one meal a week? And instead of eating, we take that time to read the word and to pray. Seems like a simple ask. So if you are, like, medically okay to do that, that's the plan. But then also, what a lot of people do is find other ways to interrupt their, like, food rhythms. And so people will, for 40 days, the term is, like, give up. I'm giving this up for Lent. But what you really should say is, like, I'm fasting from this kind of food rhythm. It could be a number of things. And that's really something you just ask the Lord, like, hey, what would most anger my body in a way that is, like, going to reveal some really important things to me? Because it's not just about what you take out, it's about what you replace it with. And it's this desire to say, God, you're doing something during this time. You think about millions and millions of believers around the world taking time to fast during a 40-day period. Don't you want to be a part of that movement of God? Well, Dallas Willard, he talks about fasting in this way. He says to fast is to fasten yourself to what God is doing. He uses the analogy of a seatbelt. You fasten a seatbelt. And so when we are fasting, we are fastening ourselves to this thing that God is doing during this 40 days in the wilderness. And what will happen is he will start to show us things about our lives. And Lent kind of has this like kind of love-hate relationship where it's uncomfortable because you're physically uncomfortable, but also it's starting to reveal some things and God's shaping you and molding you. And it's not fun in that way, but it's also, you're like, but this is good, you know? And if you don't believe me, then I'll just say, well, just try it this year. And if it's not your thing, then, you know, whatever. But everyone who's really done it will come away from it saying, okay, I love God more. I hear him differently. I'm more aware of my sin patterns. I'm more convicted about it. I'm more aggressive in the pursuit of holiness. And so we fasten ourselves to it, to what he is doing. And if you are like, hey, this fasting thing sounds foreign to me. I want to do it like it sounds interesting, but I want to know more. Chris Cole is going to come and give a little plug for an equipping class that he's doing that will help target fasting in a way that is like really, really, I think, very special and very purposed. And so, Chris, come on up. Y'all clap for Chris. Everybody likes to be clapped for, right?
Thank you. So for 4 straight weeks, starting on the first Sunday of Lent, February 18th, I will be facilitating a equipping class all about fasting. So we're going to gather together, we're going to learn about fasting, but more importantly, we're going to make actionable steps of, okay, how do I incorporate this into my weekly rhythms? How do I do this thing that is very tough, like Josh said, that's very hard? And then we will gather back together the next week and say, hey, this was hard. And we will sort of help bear that burden of fasting together. So if Lent is a thing where we are looking to Jesus as the model in the wilderness and his 40-day fast, then we see Jesus being not weakened, but empowered by his fast. It is through the fasting and the prayer that he has the power to resist the devil's temptations, the power to fill up his spirit and just connect to the Father in such a powerful way. And there's a beautiful, profound just mystery about fasting that when we reject the fact that we need to eat 3 meals a day, that we need to fill our bellies before we can do anything else, when we go hungry on purpose, the Lord uses that in a very spiritual and strange and hard to describe way to reveal, okay, where do appetites, where do desires have their talons in me? And then through that, we draw closer to the Lord, and he can start to remove some of those strongholds, some of the grips that the world has in us. So I just want to invite you, if fasting is a foreign thing for you, if you've never done it or you've tried for a week or two in the past few years and it was like, I don't know if I'm doing this right. You probably were, and you were probably getting angry or hangry and you just didn't want to keep going. That's fine. It's totally relatable. We all get there. But I just want to invite you to come to this class, learn more about it, and more importantly, do it together. So it's a communal thing. We'll be using John Mark Comer's Practicing the Way curriculum to sort of help guide us through it. And if you want to sign up, the sign up is live on Church Center. If you open the app, it's right there. There's a little button you can click. Join that group. If the 9:15 hour, so this class will be at 9:15 for 4 straight weeks. If that doesn't work for you because you're in a group or you're serving with youth or kids or up here, there is another option. Just let me know and I can add you to the other group. So yeah, I hope you join us. If you're still not sure, just take a week to pray about it and then let me know. So thank you.
So fasting is the main thing. It's really the only thing that we know about Jesus, like what he did in the desert. We know that he was tempted, and there's a lot of those kind of things to it. But in addition to fasting, there's some other things that are a part of the journey. There's also the idea of abstaining, which is different than fasting. Fasting is food-related. Abstaining is what else can I carve out of my life that's going to get my attention? And so you have people who they'll abstain from TV in some way. Social media a lot of times is a thing. I did a thing one year where you can gray screen your phone. And I did that one year, which is I abstained from color, I guess. I don't know how to explain that. But there's plenty of different ways. You're like, what else can I disrupt in my life that's going to help me fast into what God's doing? We will also, we'll read together. We will we'll pray certain things. They're just like other kinds of rhythms that are in addition to fasting. And so that'll all start on Ash Wednesday on the 14th. So you got 10 days, okay? You got 10 days to figure out what needs to happen next for me. And you might be wondering, what does this have to do with Jonah? Like, how does all this fit together? Like, is this all just being a big commercial for Lent? And I will say no, it's not been a big commercial for Lent. This is me sensing God saying, like, hey, there's maybe necessary a 10-day or more on-ramp to rent. Lent. Like, maybe it takes a little while instead of just like, okay, Mardi Gras over, Ash Wednesday's here, now what? I think God's been laying groundwork for a couple of weeks. And really, you could probably go back way further than that. But I think that the Jonah story fits into some things. And so, you know, Jonah is a kind of a complicated human. And I keep coming back to this thing of like, what's his biggest problem? Because Jonah was struggling, and it's fine to struggle. There's nothing wrong with struggling. But this story is here, I think, to help us see some things. And as I said for a few weeks, Jonah kind of holds up a mirror to us. And he's kind of a caricature where there's like some exaggerated things about human tendencies that I think God wants us to see in him. And we look at Jonah and we say, oh man, I would never do that. But if you just scale it back a little bit, you're like, but I kind of do some of those things just maybe in my own sort of ways. And here's what I think Jonah's biggest problem was in this story. I think that there was a lack of transformation in his life. I think that's the biggest problem, is lack of transformation. Like, he had all the right, like, information about God and what God was doing. He had all the data. He had all the scriptures. He had all the, it was all there. But it wasn't changing him. That's a problem. Jonah wasn't, he was not ignorant, you know. He wasn't, like, totally clueless. I mean, God even says, he describes the city of Nineveh. He says, they don't know their right hand from their left, which is a way of saying, like, they truly have never been taught these things. They truly are ignorant in the sense they just don't know any different. They don't know any better. But Jonah knew his right hand from his left. It just wasn't changing him. It wasn't morphing him. It wasn't doing the things that we want all that to do. There was, I keep thinking of this phrase, and I was so hesitant to say it because it's cheesy, but cheesy rhymes are like the dad jokes of preaching. And so there was information, but there was no transformation. So I kept thinking about it. It was all in his head, but it wasn't, there's a disconnect between his head and his heart. And so that's not good, right? And I started to think about my life and our lives, that we live in this information age, right? Like, we don't wonder about a whole lot. Very quickly, you could take out your phone and find out the answer to most questions that you have. And so we're just used to, like, we're just constantly filling our minds with all these things. But my question is it changing us? And is a part of what God doing holding up a mirror to us and saying, hey, is the information transforming you or not? And Lent is the perfect time to, like, ask that question to the Lord and see what we do about it. Now, there's some more examples that I have from Jonah's life. Let me offer you a little bit of proof that Jonah knew what He had all the information. First of all, he was a prophet. So this is 2 Kings 14. This is the other place we find Jonah show up in the Bible. Verse 25 says, he, talking about the king, restored the border of Israel from Lebo Hamath. You know where that is, right? As far as the Sea of Arabah. Okay, so you know where we are on the globe. According to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke by his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath-Hepher. Okay, so that's the same, Jonah, son of Amittai, same name. And so Jonah is a prophet. God has given him words to speak to this king. So we know that there's like, okay, so he knows something. If out of all the people that are there to be prophets, like Jonah's one of them. If you look, though, in Jonah 1, 7 through 9, this is the part of the story where God has told him, go to Nineveh and preach to them about the evil that's going on there. Jonah goes the opposite direction, 5 times as far, because he hates Nineveh, which is the capital city of Assyria. So he's basically like, go to your enemy and preach to him. And he's like, no. So he flees from the Lord, goes the other direction. He gets on a boat, and the boat is out on the water. A big storm comes up, and the sailors are not Jewish, and so they are like praying to all their different gods, asking them to calm the storm. Jonah's asleep in the bottom of the boat, just being zero help. And they wake him up, and they're like, you pray to your God. Who are you? Who are you? Where are you from? Like asking all these kind of questions. Like, you need to pray to your God because maybe your God can do something about this storm. And so when they're interrogating him, this is the part of that story. Look at verse 7. Come, let us cast lots that we may know on whose account this evil has come upon us. So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. And they said to him, tell us on whose account this evil has come upon us. What's your occupation? Where do you come from? What is your country? Of what people are you? And this is his answer. He said to them, I am a Hebrew. I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. Okay? That is the right answer. He kind of almost like sums up a lot of what we know about God from the Old Testament, right? He's a Hebrew, so he's part of he's part of Israel. He's one of Abraham's descendants. He worships the Lord. That word Lord there is in all caps, which means that's the personal covenant name of God, Yahweh. He calls him by his name, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land, basically saying, yeah, he's the one that made all this, so of course he can do something about this storm. So he that's the right answer. Like, he knew all the information right there. And, the story keeps going. They throw him overboard. He's like, throw me in the water. All this will take care of itself. And so he's in this place where he's like, I would rather die than watch God be kind to my enemy. So even knowing what he knows about the Lord, his covenantal name, he knows his heritage, he knows the power of God, he knows all these things, he still is like, but I'd still rather die than watch him get his way. So they throw him overboard. God, being awesome and faithful and good, is like, okay, well, this is not the end for you, Jonah. He sends this big fish who swallows him up. Jonah's in the belly, in the womb of this fish for 3 days, 3 nights, which is a Hebrew way of saying a long journey. He prays this prayer, which we see in chapter 2, and the fish vomits him up. I was going to say spits him up, but how many times do you get to say vomit in your sermons? It's in the Bible, so I just said it. And so while he's in the belly of the fish, he has this prayer, which is all of chapter 2, which I'm not going to read all of chapter 2, but you need to know this, that within chapter 2, there are at least 14 quotes from the Old Testament in his prayer. Psalms, different places, mostly from the Psalms. So that's my third piece of like why I know he knew the information. One, he was a designated prophet by God. Two, his answer to the sailors was spot on. Three, in his prayer from the womb belly of this fish, he is just quoting the Bible. Here's the fourth and last thing. So fish vomits him up on the dry land. God says, let's try this again. Go to your enemy's capital city and preach to them. He goes to the city, preaches the worst sermon probably that's ever happened in proportion to the like fruitfulness, because the city repents. And it makes him furious. Once again, he finds himself, I would rather be dead than watch you be kind to my enemies. Okay? Disconnect between the head and the heart. And so he's sitting on this hillside and he's looking at this city, and the assumption from everyone is like he's sitting on the hill just hoping that even though they're repenting, God's still going to just send fire from heaven and smoke them. That's kind of what everyone assumes. He's just stewing. And so God comes up and he's like, hey, how's that working out for you? And they have this dialogue. We look at the beginning of chapter 4, 1 and 2. But it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was angry. And he prayed to the Lord and said, O Lord, is not this what I said when I was yet in my country? That is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish. For I knew, and here it is, that you are a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and relenting from disaster. That is direct quotes from Exodus 34. That is God's self-description that shows up throughout the scripture. That is God saying, there's a few times where God's like, let me just tell you who I am. This is the most descriptive one, and became a part of like what the Hebrews would remind each other of, what they would pray, what they would sing, is like, this is who our God is. He nails it. He quotes it. But that truth was not changing him. See? Disconnect between the head and the heart. Information, no transformation. That's a problem. So, of course, it makes sense to him to run the other direction from the Lord, because he disagrees with what God's doing. Like, of course, if he's not changing, that's a logical kind of explanation. Of course it would make sense that he would go to Nineveh and preach the bare minimum of a sermon, because it's not changing him. He doesn't have compassion. He doesn't understand what God's doing. He knows all these things about God, but it's not making a difference. And if he is a caricature of us, if God is using the Jonah story to put up a mirror and help us to see some things, we have to consider our own ways and our own patterns. Are we too filling our heads with information that's not changing us? Are we morphing? Are we transforming? Are we changing? Are we becoming people who love God more and more? Or are we just becoming more moral people? I think that is a fear of mine for myself and for us. Isn't that like, and this is not a diagnosis, so don't hear me saying, this is us, we got to do something different. I'm asking the question of my own life, and I'm encouraging you to ask the question of your life as well. Like, are you different? Are you changing? Or are you just becoming a better citizen, nicer person? Those are different things. And some would say that those are not the two different things, but I want to also, once again, go to the book of Jonah to show what I'm talking about, maybe in different ways. So if you go back to chapter 1, the response of the sailors. So Jonah says, I'm a Hebrew, I fear the Lord, the God who made all of this. They throw him overboard, and the storm like ceases. And that confirms what Jonah had just said. Like, I worship Yahweh. He made all this. He controls all this. Throw me overboard. He's trying to get my attention, not your attention. Throw me overboard. All this will be fine. And the storm stops. And so you have these sailors who are not Jewish. They don't know Yahweh. They don't know anything other than what this guy's told them, probably. Maybe they've heard things, but that's not their God. That's his God. And the storm calms, and something connected to them. And look at their response in verse 16. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. Okay? So that word fear, that is like not the best English translation of the word. It's not fear as in like I'm terrified. It is terrified in terms of like I'm scared. It's fear in terms of like the awesomeness of God. It's more about like awe than it is terror. So it's not like the 13th gate. It's like this like, whoa, like I'm overwhelmed by the power of this God. It says they feared the Lord exceedingly. Notice L-O-R-D capital letters. You'll find in the Bible there's different ways God is talked about. And when you see Lord in all caps, that's the covenant personal name of God. If the O-R-D is not capitalized, that's a different root word. If it's the word God, that's a different word. They use the same word Jonah used, but that's the name. That name was so sacred that like Jews got to where they would not write it or even say it. It was too holy to write and too holy to speak. They were in awe of that God. They offered a sacrifice to the Lord. And in their time, that's how they worshiped, right? That's like what it meant. It was like, God, we want to show you your worth to us. And so we will take these animals and we will sacrifice them. We want you to see on the outside what's going on the inside. They made a sacrifice to the Lord and they made vows. They made a commitment to him. That's an incredible response. Okay. Now, look at chapter 3. Jonah goes to Nineveh, preaches a terrible sermon, honestly. But even the worst sermons, God can get up in the middle of that and use it. And so he goes around, 5 words in Hebrew, 40 days Nineveh will be overthrown. And they believe what's happening. And there's a part of the story gets into what the king did. And so look at verse 7. The king issued a proclamation and published through Nineveh. By the decree of the king of his nobles, let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock taste anything. So that's fasting. There it is one more time in case you are trying to pretend that we're not talking about fasting. Let them not feed or drink water, but let man and beast be covered with sackcloth, and let them call out mightily to God. Here is this. Let everyone turn from his evil way and from the violence that's in his hands. Who knows? God may turn and relent and turn from his fierce anger so that we may not perish. Okay, that's their response. Now, that's amazing, right? There's a difference. One, there's the word God there is Elohim, which is not the same as Yahweh. Elohim is used in a lot of different contexts and is not as specific as God, right? So that's different, but I didn't catch this. Tim Keller wrote a book called The Prodigal Prophet, and he points out that Jonah is kind of like both of the sons in the prodigal son story. Like he's the rebellious younger son at times, and he's the like kind of stuck up, whatever, older son, self-righteous son in the back half of the story, and then God's the awesome father the whole time. But Keller points out that what happened in Nineveh was just more like social reform. Like it says very specifically in verse 8, let everyone turn from his evil way and from the violence that's in his hands. There's no mention of Yahweh. There's no mention of like deep repentance. They didn't like get saved. Like it wasn't like one of those kinds of things. They were like, hey, we need to stop killing each other. That's a problem. And the reaction of those two groups is exactly what I'm talking about. Because we would look at Nineveh and we would say, that's incredible. We should be more like that. And that's true. But what we're going for is the sailors, right? Like, we're going for the, like, praise Yahweh. Let us sacrifice and make vows. And my concern is that the first one, it feels good enough, and that we can stop there, you know? Yeah, God's doing this thing, and guess what? I'm less mean than I used to be. Or maybe it's like, hey, I'm doing better than I ever thought I would. Or, hey, I'm doing better than what was done to me. You know, those kinds of things. And we're settling for morality instead of, like, lovers of God. And again, I'm not laying this on us as a diagnosis. I just think it's an important enough question to ask, especially where we live, the time that we live, how much information is coming our way, that we don't want to just be pursuing social reform. We want to be pursuing, like, I love the Lord. I am sacrificing to him. I'm making vows to him. I know his name. And so I think we have to come to the Lord and we have to ask his opinion about these kinds of things. I think it's important. I think that's what he's been, like laying the groundwork to do. I think that's what this long on-ramp to Lent is about, in part, is getting us to the point where we're like, okay, there's some Jonah in me that needs to get out of me, and I don't know how to do that necessarily, or maybe I'm starting to get a sense of it. I'm going to fasten myself to what God's doing on the planet and in my own church family and in my, like, community group and however that needs to. I'm going to fasten myself to what he's doing. I'm going to disrupt my rhythms because I don't want to sit there and, like, join Jonah on the hillside. I don't want to settle for social reform in my own life. I want to be the increasing, like, lover of the Lord. And so we start to look around our lives and we think about our lives. Like, think about your life as a spouse. Like, is this happening? Like, are you and your helpmate helping one another love God more and more and more and more? I hope so. It is possible, though, that you're just trying to do better than your parents did, you know? Like, you're trying to be a better couple than you grew up watching, maybe? Same thing as parents. Like, are you raising your parents to love God, or are you raising them just to, like, not get in trouble at school? Those are different things. Now, it's good to not get in trouble at school. That's important, but the goal is, I want my kids to be absolutely in love with the Lord. And they learn it at home. Like, that's where it happens. Our kids group is amazing. Youth group is amazing. All these things are happening. Fantastic. Number one influence on kids, parents. Every study that's ever been done points to it. I haven't read them all. But most of the studies, every study I have read always comes back to the home. I think we have to think about that in our friendships. Are friendships pushing one another to love God more? Or are we just kind of like hanging out and this, you know? I keep going. Think about yourself as an employee, as an employer, as a coworker, as a neighbor, as a stranger. You know, like, you can, as a stranger to someone else, you can help them love the Lord more. You can. They may not really know what it is or know what to call it, but if Jonah can have that impact on those sailors, God will use whatever. And so it's like, what do you do? It's like, if you're sitting here right now and you'd be like, there is a disconnect between my head and my heart. Like, I have so much information. I consume so many podcasts and sermons and books and all this kind of stuff, but I am the same person I was a year ago. What do I do about it? The first thing I would say is, well, you got to ask the Lord. Like, I can't, that's not what I'm here to do, is to tell you the answer to those things. I can sit with you. Our staff would love to sit with you and help you figure out, like, what to pray, those kind of things. But I can't just tell you, like, here's step one, do this. Other than step one is ask the Lord. He will lead you. It is his joy to lead us in the process of becoming more like him. And I know that Lent and Ash Wednesday and all that stuff is not in the Bible, but I believe that he like gave great brilliance to his people way before we came along and said, hey, there is something about saying, I'm going to do what Jesus did. I'm going to sit in the wilderness and I'm going to fast. And I'm going to attach myself to what God is doing. And the part of what's amazing is that if we're all doing it, you're more likely to do it. And so what I would say is you need to start to ask the Lord, what does my 40-day journey need to look like? And Lent is perfect for this endeavor. And that's why I think he's been getting us ready for it. And we got 10 more days. Not that you have to wait until Ash Wednesday. You can do it today, you know, but I know it's intense. Lent has a very different intensity than Advent does and stuff. They all have their own personality. But take what he's stirring within you and ask him, what is my 40 days supposed to look like? What does fasting look like for me? Talk about it as couples. Talk about it with your friends. Talk about it as a family. Parents, lead your kids to do it somehow. I know kids need to eat. I get that. They don't have to eat everything. Trust them with it. Get them to pray. You ask God, what do you think you're supposed to fast from during this time? Like, how transformational. So much of fasting during Lent in our culture has been like, well, I got to give this up. I got to give up sweets till Easter, you know, kind of roll our eyes at it. Instead of like, well, I'm going to fasten myself to what God's doing in this really special thing. And here's my sacrifice as I'm going to go without this. And here's my vow as I'm going to go without this. Because I want to know what you're doing. You are doing something. I'm attaching myself to it. So start to ask yourself that. Ask yourself what you're targeting. Like, what's the goal of your fasting? Not just the technical things of I'm going to go without this, I'm going to replace it with this. Not just those things, but also like, but what am I asking him to do? What's the target goal? Like, what do I want different about my life on the other side of this? What we know about Jesus is that he fasted for 40 days. He was tempted the whole time. We have three specific things. On the other side of it, he comes out of it. It says he was hungry. Doi. And then right away, he goes in the power of the Spirit and begins to minister. We know he was strong on the other side, even though he was hungry. What will you look like on the other side? Strong, maybe a little hungry, you know. Maybe so much is different. Maybe you are less Jonah-like on the other side. And that's what we're asking God to do, because we can't do it without his help. We can do social reform without his help. We can't worship Yahweh, and make vows, and sacrifice. Like, we can't be those kinds of people without his help. And so we're coming to him, we're saying, will you be gracious and compassionate to us? Will you be slow to anger and abound in steadfast love to us? Because we know that's who you are. And you may be sitting here and be like, hey, I am not who I was. And I hope that we can look at it and say, all right, I'm not completely clueless about it. Like, God's not done zero things in my life. You know, like, I'm morphing. But what that does is it has a way of making us hungry for more. And so maybe for you, Lent is like, man, I just want more of it. Or maybe you're like, hey, I got tons of information. None of it is changing me. I got to do something about it. Maybe that's kind of where you are. You also might be like, hey, I don't even know if I know the Lord at all. Like, this whole, everything that you're talking about is foreign to me. And maybe that's why God brought you here today. And you don't need to leave here with those same questions. That's a part of what we're here to do. And so the next couple of minutes, like, we're going to sing, and we're going to, maybe some people here praying. There's communion over here to the right. Jesus gave us a meal and said, hey, when you are responding to me, you need grace, and I'm here to offer you grace. And so every time we're together, we have this over here as this reminder that, hey, Jesus has provided what you need to walk in this. No matter how stuck in the patterns you feel, no matter any of those things. If you go back to beginning of July, we started on a long journey through the Lord's Prayer. And every Sunday, in some capacity, we talked about on earth as it is in heaven, over and over and over again, this prayer he's given us, this, like, make me this kind of person. The kind of life where your name is made famous through the way that I live, through provision and my gratitude for it, through forgiveness being extended like you have forgiven me, through saying no to temptation and the paths that are there and yes to the path of righteousness. Would you make my life look like heaven so much that your name is exalted, so that the sailors in my life are looking and saying something is different right there? We spent months talking about that and praying through that. And I don't think this is different. I think this is just the next stage of us dealing with those same things starts to look like. I think he's leading us in that direction. And I hope that you will say yes. And I hope that I will say yes. My plan is to say yes, in case you're wondering. And we'll do it together. And so let's continue to give ourselves to this. And so for the next few minutes, we're going to sing, and you can come here and pray these steps. Communion will be available to your right. And if you don't know where you stand with the Lord, let all that happen. Watch it. Soak it all in. Stick around after. Ask some questions. That's what we're here to do, is to make sure that we're not just doing social reform, that people know the Lord, capital L-O-R-D. Right? Let's stand together. Lord, we have to have your grace, like you doing what we can't do on our own. We have to have that in order to respond ever in any way. We can't. Like in you, we live and move and have our being. And so all of our desire to respond to you has to be empowered by you. And I'm reminded, I want to relay this reminder, that you stand ready to empower our efforts to say yes. And God, as much as none of us really want to look at Jonah and see ourselves, we have to be honest and say, yeah, I can fall into that. I can get tripped up by that. I can relate. And I'm thankful that as the mirror is there, you're the one holding it up, but you do so in kindness and with graciousness, and you stand ready to help us deal with the things that you're showing us. And so the next few minutes, as we sing and pray and receive communion and just kind of move around the room, would you use all these things together to continue to point us in a direction, and to know that you have gone ahead of us, you come behind us, to our left, to our right, that we don't journey alone. We're with you, we're with one another. And may our next few minutes just help pack in some dirt on top of the seeds that you planted today, so that those seeds can come to life. We love you. We thank you. And I pray this in your name. Amen. All right. Our communion table is ready. You can come as you want as we respond for the next few minutes together.